Started a new series through the book of 1 Samuel. Samuel transitions us in Israel's history from the time of judges to the time of kings. From the first time of worship in the tabernacle in Shiloh to worship in the temple in Jerusalem. 1 and 2 Samuel are bookended with a prayer to the Lord. While there are several key figures in Samuel, God is the central figure who connects the whole of 1 and 2 Samuel. Last week, we met Hannah, a barren wife who is mocked and mistreated by her rival. She promised God that if he would give her a son, she would give the son back to God. She was misunderstood by the priest as she poured out her heart in prayer to God, but God heard her prayer, and God answered her prayer. God gave her a son, and she named him Samuel. This morning, we see what happens next. Go ahead and turn to 1 Samuel, if you would. This morning, we will look at 1 Samuel chapter 1, verses 21 through chapter 2, verse 11. If you're using one of the church Bibles, you'll find that on page 225, about 20% of the way through your Bible, page 225. 1 Samuel is the ninth book of the Bible. You have Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, and then Joshua, Judges, Ruth, and finally, 1 Samuel. We'll see two main points in our text this morning. Hannah gives Samuel to the Lord, and Hannah gives praise to the Lord. So again, Hannah gives Samuel to the Lord, and Hannah gives praise to the Lord. Let's read 1 Samuel chapter 1, beginning in verse 21. The man Elkanah and all his house went up to offer to the Lord the yearly sacrifice and to pay his vow. But Hannah did not go up, for she said to her husband, "As soon as the child is weaned, I will bring him, so that he may appear in the presence of the Lord and dwell there forever." Elkanah, her husband, said to her, "Do what seems best to you. Wait until you have weaned him. Only may the Lord establish his word." So the woman remained and nursed her son until she weaned him. And when she had weaned him, she took him up with her, along with a three-year-old bull, an ephah of flour, and a skin of wine. And she brought him to the house of the Lord at Shiloh. And the child was young. Then they slaughtered the bull, and they brought the child to Eli. And she said, "O my Lord, as you live, my Lord, I am the woman who is standing here in your presence, my Lord, praying to the Lord. For this child I prayed, and the Lord has granted me my petition that I made to him. Therefore I have lent him to the Lord. As long as he lives, he is lent to the Lord." And he worshipped the Lord there. First main point that we see in our text, Hannah gives Samuel to the Lord. Hannah gives Samuel to the Lord. As we begin in verse 21, we see that things do not happen immediately. Elkanah is taking his family up for the yearly sacrifice. He is being faithful. This year, Hannah doesn't go. It may appear at first glance that Hannah is stepping back on her promise. She said she would give her child to the Lord, and now she's saying she's just going to wait a little longer. But within the context of our whole text, we do see that she intended to fulfill her vow, and she does, in fact, fulfill her vow by the end of the text. The delay was simply her weaning the child. Before she can give him to Eli, Samuel has to be able to live on solid food. So that's exactly what Hannah does. She keeps him until he's weaned, which would have been up to 3 to 5 years in that culture. Then after he can be cared for without his mother present, then she will take him to Eli. Elkanah supports her in her decision, but he also adds, "Only may the Lord establish his word." It's not certain what word of the Lord he has in mind, but perhaps the idea is that the Lord has given his word in the sense of giving Hannah this child that she asked for. And so the word of the Lord will be established when Hannah carries out her promise. So Elkanah supports her, but only within the purpose of fulfilling the promises. In verse 24, we see the fulfillment of Hannah's promise. Hannah finishes weaning Samuel, and she sets out to fulfill her promise to God. In addition, Hannah brings what would be considered an abundant sacrifice. They fulfill the covenant requirements and then some, and they make the sacrifice in worship to God. What Hannah has done is really hard for us to fathom. She has taken the thing she most wants in the world, and as soon as she is able, she gives it over to God. She got a couple few short years with this son that she had prayed for years, and then she gave him to God. For the rest of her life, she will only see her beloved son for special occasions. Now, one might say that almost all mothers have to give up their sons eventually, which is true. It's just not usually at age 3. Most of us could not even imagine giving up our child at age 3. That's why God gave us the teenage years. In verse 26, Hannah reminds Eli who she is. I'm the one who is here praying to the Lord. And notice that she gives God credit for this child. She asked the Lord for this child, and the Lord has granted her petition. The Lord has granted her request. The Lord has given her a son. And now she's going to give that child, that gift, back to God. She is taking God's gift to her and returning him right back to God. Hannah is an example to us of giving to God as he has given to us. God calls us to give generously for his kingdom, but when we give to God and his purposes, we are merely giving back to God that which he has first given to us. Our giving is a recognition that everything we have comes from God. There is nothing we have that God did not first grant to us. Hannah recognizes that her son is a gift of God. She prayed specifically for a child. God has given her a child. Likewise, we should be looking for all the ways that God answers our requests, acknowledging that God has heard us and thanking God for providing for us, seeing all the abundant ways that God has blessed us. Sometimes we don't see how God has given to us simply because we are not looking. We can take any request that we have to God and know that he will hear us. And we know he will do what is best for us. So we can trust God to act for our good and for his glory, and we should be looking for how he will answer our prayers. As chapter 2 begins, we have Hannah's prayer, but bookending Hannah's prayer, we have two statements about Samuel. At the end of chapter 1, the last line we see, and he worshiped the Lord there. And then we have Hannah's prayer in chapter 2, verses 1 through 10. And then after Hannah's prayer in chapter 2, verse 11, we read, then Elkanah went home to Ramah, and the boy was ministering to the Lord in the presence of Eli the priest. It seems that the author of Samuel is previewing the next phase of Samuel's life. Samuel is probably less than 5 years old. It seems unlikely that Samuel understands enough of the moment to be the one whose worship we're identifying, and he's a little young to be ministering to the Lord. So probably what we're seeing is a pre-highlight of what Samuel begins to do now that he is with Eli. It represents what happens now that Samuel is delivered over to the Lord. Samuel's new life serving God in Shiloh is a life of worship and service to the Lord. That's our first section. Hannah gives Samuel to the Lord. Second main point, Hannah gives praise to the Lord. Hannah gives praise to the Lord. Beginning in chapter 2, verse 1, we see that Hannah prayed a prayer of praise to the Lord. Hannah's prayer is considered one of the oldest examples of Hebrew poetry that we have. Hannah's prayer is in the form of poetry, a poetic prayer. Most English Bibles highlight poetry by making each poetic line a single line by itself and in setting it a little bit so that it sticks out from regular narrative, which has full sentences and paragraphs. Even digital Bibles usually do that. You can probably see in your own Bible this morning that verses 1 through 10 are understood to be poetry. When we think of poetry in English, we think of rhyme and rhythm or meter. Hebrew poetry is more about parallelism and precise words and imagery. At least a third of the Old Testament is poetry, some would argue an even higher figure. The most common pattern in Hebrew poetry is parallelism, where two or more lines in a row are directly connected to each other. Often the second line is repeating something very similar to the first line, in which case it might expand on the idea of the first line or else really narrow the focus. Sometimes the second line goes the opposite direction, highlighting distinctions. A third category of parallelism is called synthetic parallelism, where the second line finishes the idea from the first line without any comparison or contrast. So parallelism is the first aspect of Hebrew poetry, and it means the lines relate to each other in some way. Another aspect of Hebrew poetry is condensed wording. Ideas are expressed with fewer words. All spare words are eliminated, very terse wording. Lastly, imagery is a very common aspect of Hebrew poetry. The Lord is my shepherd. He makes me lie down in green pastures. The imagery represents the underlying meaning. It is a bit hard to determine exactly where the breaks are in the poem, and scholars are divided. In poetry, we can refer to individual sections as verses, but we can't do that in biblical poetry because we've already used verse to describe the number breaks. So we'll use the word stanza to refer to the breaks in the poem. Some consider verse 1 as a standalone stanza, but others continue the first stanza through verse 3. If you use the English Standard Version, as I do, you can see by the spacing that they view verse 1 as a single section. Verses 2 and 3 don't seem to me to have absolutely clear markers connecting to verse 1 or to the verses that follow. They also don't have clear markers breaking them from the verses around them. It doesn't make a strong difference. The most common breaking point for the second stanza is the end of verse 8, although some choose verse 5. Then the third section goes through verse 10. For the sake of simplicity, I'm going with the markers that the English Standard Version used. So verse 1 is stanza 1, verses 2 through 8 are the second stanza, and verses 9 through 10 are the final stanza. Verse 1 is about what God has done already for Hannah. Verses 2 through 8 expand on that theme by highlighting how God acts more universally. Then verses 9 through 10 highlight what God will do in the future. So Hannah is giving her own testimony of what God has done for her, showing how that is consistent with how God acts in general, and then highlighting how God will act in the future in bringing justice to the world. Now let's consider verse 1. This is what God has done for Hannah, his completed work for Hannah. Lines 1 and 2 of this poetic prayer clearly go together. And Hannah prayed and said, "My heart exults in the Lord. My horn is exalted in the Lord." So first line, she praises the Lord. She rejoices in the Lord. She is amazed by the Lord. That is the idea of the first line. And parallel line, she is exalted by the Lord. Her horn is exalted by the Lord. Think of two bulls with horns fighting one another. The victorious bull lifts up its head, and so it's lifting up its horn in victory. So her horn is exalted in that God has given her victory. She may have been despised and mocked by her rival because of her barrenness, but she is barren no longer. She is lifting up God's name because God lifted her up. She is exalting God because God has exalted her. The second set of lines in verse 1 likewise go together. "My mouth derides my enemies because I rejoice in your salvation." In our context, Hannah's enemy is Peninnah. And God's salvation is the reversal of fortune, that Hannah has now received a child. Hannah has been the object of extended mockery and derision. Peninnah delighted in reminding Hannah that she had no children. But God has saved Hannah from her situation. God has granted her a son. Peninnah can never take that away. Now Hannah can be the one who derides her enemy instead of the other way around. That might sound harsh, but as we read this poetic prayer, understand that what Peninnah has been doing is opposing the one who trusts in God. We don't know whether Peninnah believed in God or not, but her actions were in opposition to God. She was mocking Hannah for what God had brought about in Hannah's life. Hannah's barrenness was God's design, and Peninnah mocked her for it. So in that sense, Peninnah is rightly considered Hannah's enemy. But although Peninnah has had the upper hand, Hannah has remained faithful to the Lord. Despite her barrenness, she continued trusting in the Lord. She received abuse and mockery. She was oppressed and mistreated. Now, the Lord has saved her from the provoking and irritating and grieving because she trusted in the Lord. The Lord has vindicated her for her faithfulness. Peninnah had the upper hand before, but no longer. Now Hannah can deride her enemy, not because of anything about herself. Hannah can deride her enemy because her enemy was really opposed to God. Look what God has done. God has saved. The second section of this prayer is about what God does in general. Verses 3 through 8 are about God's present work in the world. Verse 1 is about what God has done for Hannah. Starting in verse 2, Hannah expands beyond herself to who God is and what he has done in general. It seems that Hannah's prayer is intentionally a public prayer. Her prayer in chapter 1 was a private prayer that Eli happened to have seen but not heard, and interpreted but not understood. This prayer is a challenge to those around her, and I think we can even say that this prayer was in part for Peninnah to overhear. Verse 2 is one of those foundational verses you can pin up to your wall and hang on to. It's a really foundational proclamation about God. The first two lines build upon each other. The third line is founded on the first two and makes it real and personal and practical for us. Line 1, there is none holy like the Lord. To say God is holy is to say he is set apart, he is perfect, he is flawless, God is high and exalted. God's holiness is the sum total of his infinite perfections. There is none holy like the Lord. You take the best possible human with the best possible character, he or she is not holy like the Lord. You take any other deity that people have believed in across time, that deity is not holy like the Lord. There is none holy like the Lord. Line 2, for there is none besides you. This is an intensification of God's holiness. Line 1, there is none holy like the Lord. Line 2, in fact, there is none like the Lord at all. No one can compare to God. No one is like him. But the fact that God is completely holy beyond all others, the fact that there is none like God, is only helpful to us if we have reason to believe that God is for us. Because God could be holy and God could be alone God, but be against us. If God is holy and set apart, but he is against us, then we are entirely lost. So the third line of this triplet highlights that he is our God, and we are his people, and he is for us, and he is invincible. There is no rock like our God. There is no rock like our God. One, he is our God. We belong to him. He acts on our behalf. We are his. Two, God is our rock. He is our anchor. He is our firm foundation. He is omnipotent, all-powerful. There is no power or force or might that can contend with God. There is nothing God cannot do. There is no one who can overcome God. We are safe because God is our rock, and we are safe in the cleft of the rock. There is no rock like our God. We have a transition in verses 3 through 5. Verse 2 is foundational about our God. Verses 3 through 5 are about how God reverses fortunes. Talk no more so very proudly. Let not arrogance come from your mouth. For the Lord is a God of knowledge, and by him actions are weighed. Verse 3 is condemning the pride of those who think they've got it all together. Those who think they are better, those who speak as if they are above everyone else. Stop your prideful speech, abandon your arrogant word, because the Lord knows. The scales of justice are before him. He sees what is really happening. Taking all of this as a connected thought, justice is coming to the haughty. God will bring judgment on the prideful and arrogant. Consider Peninnah, so long mocking this faithful follower of God, she won't be mocking any more. Justice will come to those who have oppressed and provoked God's people. Verse 4, the bows of the mighty are broken, but the feeble bind on strength. Bow here is talking about a bow and arrow, not the bough of a tree. During this time, bow and arrow and sword and spear were the weapons of war. Powerful armies would have had archers with bows, so the bow is a sign of strength. But now the bows of the mighty are broken. You can still find some use in some broken weapons. There's no use in a broken bow. Even the one who was mighty is now defenseless with a broken bow. That's how Hannah is describing the powerful who oppose God. A reversal of fortune. The bows of the mighty are broken. And then the parallel line highlights the other side. The feeble bind on strength. The weak have become strong. God has given power to the frail one. Their fortunes have been reversed. Notice the parallel imagery. The powerful have been broken, the weak infused with power and might. Verse 5 wraps up this middle portion of the second section. Those who were full have fired themselves out for bread, but those who were hungry have ceased to hunger. The barren has borne 7, but she who has many children is forlorn. Once again, we see how God has reversed the fortunes of people. Those who used to be full have made themselves indentured servants to buy food. But those who used to be hungry are now full. The one who had been barren has many children, fullness, but the one who had many children is now despondent, dejected. Those who had no longer have. Those who had not now have. God has reversed the fortunes of the lowly and the great. Again, we see how Hannah broadens from her own experience. Hannah is the one who is barren. She is barren no more. She is full now. And remember the use of imagery and wordplay. Hannah does not have 7 children, but 7 represents fullness. Hannah is complete with Samuel. On the other hand, Peninnah had many children, which made her glad, and she loved to rub it in Hannah's face that she had none. Now Hannah has a child, and Peninnah's joy is gone. Do you remember what the name of Peninnah's firstborn is? We don't know. But Hannah's son, Samuel, has been remembered for 3,000 years by everyone who reads the Bible. As we go through this life, we may be relatively unimportant on the world stage. Our contributions may not seem like much. Our life may not have global implications. But God cares about every one of his children. And one day, our fortunes will be reversed. This whole middle section of prayer is about how God works today, about God's action in the world. Verse 6, the Lord kills and brings to life. He brings down to Sheol and raises up. God is the author of life and death. The Lord is the one who kills. The Lord is the one who brings to life. God is sovereign over life and death. Death is not outside of God's control. Neither is life. Only the Lord can create life. Verse 7, the Lord makes poor and makes rich. He brings low and exalts. Verse 7 can be really challenging for Americans to accept. Many of us are taught from childhood that this isn't true. We believe the poor are poor because of their own mistakes, and the rich are rich because of their hard work. The powerful have gotten there through their own efforts, and the weak are probably there because of their own laziness. Verse 7 asserts that the Lord makes poor and makes rich. God raises up and God lowers. How do we reconcile this assertion that God is the one who lifts up and puts down with all the biblical proverbs about the rewards of diligence and the consequences of laziness? How do we reconcile that with our own experience that often those who work hard usually get ahead? The problem is that we take general principles like Proverbs and we treat them as if they are certain promises. We remember positive examples and forget the ones that go the other way. Yes, you should be diligent. No, you should not be lazy. But there are countless diligent, hard workers who have nevertheless had very little success in the world. And there are a disproportionate number of lazy people who have found their way up the ladder of success. Consider some examples of situations where people could have done everything right, but still lose everything. East Africa is in the midst of a devastating plague of locusts. In minutes, locusts have descended and farmers have lost everything. Their entire wealth wiped out. And if they borrowed for this year's crop, they have less than nothing. Australia just experienced wildfires that destroyed over 72,000 square miles of land and buildings. Just to give that some perspective, imagine a circle of land where you drive from here to Houston, and that drive is the diameter of the circle, all destroyed by fire. If you were a careful property owner in one of those zones, you are now the proud owner of ashes. Right now, you have the coronavirus going on in China, and many businesses are still closed, which means they aren't making any money. Well, who knows how long that might keep people from productivity. Working hard and doing everything right are not guarantees of success. And people who end up poor may have done everything right, everything they possibly could have done to succeed. The Lord is over all these things. The Lord is in control. The Lord accomplishes his purposes. And that leaves no room for pride to the one who has been granted worldly success. You may have worked hard for what you have, but God is the one who allowed that prosperity. He could have just as easily changed your fortunes. There's also no room for looking down on those who have less power or wealth or success. God is the one who laid out the circumstances that have resulted in their situation. The Lord makes poor and makes rich. He brings low and he exalts. Verse 8, he raises up the poor from the dust. He lifts the needy from the ash heap to make them sit with princes and inherit a seat of honor. For the pillars of the earth are the Lord's, and on them he has set the world. Once again, we see the theme of God reversing fortunes. God brings the poor from out of their poverty. God lifts the needy to the places of power. God gives an inheritance and honor to the lowly. The world measures worth by influence and power. The world values people by who they know and what they can do. But God takes the poor and lowly and puts them on an equal plane with those who have power and wealth. God created the world. He upholds the world. It all belongs to him. So it is no big deal for God to raise people up or lower them. God has no trouble lifting those who are weak and giving them strength. The final portion of the prayer is about what God will do in the future. The world does not always seem like things are as they should be, but justice will prevail in the end. Verse 9. He will guard the feet of his faithful ones, but the wicked shall be cut off in darkness. For not by might shall a man prevail. God will reverse the fortunes of the righteous and the wicked. God will protect those who belong to him. God's people will be safe under his care. On the other hand, the wicked will be destroyed. The wicked may seem to have the power now. The wicked may seem to be in control. Things may seem to go their way. But earthly power and might are not the final determiner of what happens. Not by might shall a man prevail. Verse 10 highlights the ultimate reality of God and his judgment. Evil may hold sway in the world. The wicked may prosper. The world may oppose God and his people. But these things shall not stand forever. The adversaries of the Lord shall be broken to pieces. Against them he will thunder in heaven. Those who oppose God will not stand. They may be powerful now, but one day they will be broken to pieces. God will destroy them in the hurricane of his fury. Judgment is coming. God's justice will reign. God's king will rule. Second half of verse 20, the Lord will judge the ends of the earth. He will give strength to his king and exalt the horn of his anointed. All others will be judged. No one will escape. Everyone who has opposed God will receive his wrath. All God's foes shall be utterly destroyed. They will experience God's righteous anger forever. But there is another side. The Lord will judge the ends of the earth, but he will give strength to his king. Israel did not yet have a king. The only ones anointed to that point in time were prophets or priests or judges. But God had spoken of kings for his people. And even from the beginning of Genesis, we have the promise of someone who would bring restoration. Then in Exodus, there is the promise that God would raise up a prophet like Moses. God called Aaron to be a priest to God, and God had Moses anoint Aaron. So there already were anointed prophets and priests. Hannah is looking in hope to an anointed king who will have the strength of God, an anointed king whom God will exalt in victory. Our scripture reading for our service this morning was what is often called the Magnificat, Mary's song of praise in the New Testament. You may have noticed how many parallels there are between Mary's prayer and Hannah's prayer. The prayer of Mary represents the fulfillment of Hannah's hopes and prayers. Hannah's prayed-for king had come. God's anointed would be exalted. The whole of 1 and 2 Samuel is looking forward to God's anointed king. Jesus is God's anointed king. Jesus is the one who is exalted. Jesus is the one who will break the adversaries of God to pieces. Jesus is the one who will judge the ends of the earth. Jesus is the one who overturns powers. Jesus is the one who raises up the poor and needy. Jesus is the one who brings true and final salvation. Hannah's prayer looked forward to Jesus. Hannah trusted that God would send his anointed king. And we know that God has sent his anointed king. in Hannah's prayer, we see her recognition of what God had done for her. Hannah acknowledged that what God had done for her was just a microcosm of what God does in the world. She looked forward in faith to God's salvation through his anointed king. This morning, you too must look in faith to God's anointed king. There is salvation in no one else. And for we who have trusted in Christ Jesus, we are reminded this morning that Jesus is the fulfillment of promises and pictures God made long ago. And we know that God will likewise fulfill his promises to us in Jesus. Our eternal salvation is as sure today as it was the day that Hannah praised God for it. My heart exults in the Lord. My horn is exalted in the Lord. My mouth derides my enemies because I rejoice in your salvation. There is none holy like the Lord, for there is none besides you. There is no rock like our God.